Nice to see you.
President Bill Gore.
How are you?
Goodbye.
See you.
Sure, I'm good.
Be here with you.
We appreciate it.
We'll be down there.
Next week, I guess.
Tuesday.
Looking forward to it.
This is kind of decent weather that we have here.
Yes, sir, except it's a lot warmer here than it was in Houston.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
It's been in Houston a number of times, and it's always been rather hot, rather humid. And I need to book an all-time record, I understand, but we went up to Camp Dale Saturday night, we're up there Sunday. And even there, it was 85, and... Yeah. Let's sit down.
All right, sir.
Relax.
But I would look high, you know, they're really getting imaginative. Map of the United States, I don't know.
This is starting Michigan, what does that mean?
I don't know.
Is it?
Got the Great Lakes on there, you know?
It'll be a 15-minute break.
Wonder if we get up and walk off of this? We shouldn't do that, but...
Nope.
When did you all get in town last night?
Yesterday morning, about 11:30.
I got in about noon time, roughly.
I spent a day in New York before coming, and it was even hotter up there than it is here.
Yeah, and, you know, the tall buildings and the, I don't know, the atmosphere just accentuates the heat somehow.
Well, there's like a blast from us almost.
Things are heating up a little down there, I see. Debbie was down in San Antonio yesterday and was at their big fiesta float parade going down the river and coming back. Very nice.
Mr. President, first, we'd like to thank you for inviting us to the White House to talk to you about the 1976 campaign and some of the issues facing the country today. And my first question, upon taking the presidency over, you were described as a Main Street Republican who had no ambition for the role history had thrust upon you. And I'm interested to know, why have you changed your mind and why are you seeking election?
Well, I'm seeking election because I think the policies, both at home and abroad, that I've undertaken for the United States can best be implemented by myself, that I initiated them. I think I can carry them out better than anybody else. We inherited a very difficult situation domestically with the worst economic recession in some 40 years, and our good policies have, I think, brought us on the upswing. And I know that if I have four more years, I can continue that kind of a program. And as far as foreign policy is concerned, we've achieved a peace, we're going to keep it, and I think, again, I can implement that policy better than anybody else.
Mr. President, along the road to election, how important, realistically, is the Texas primary to you?
Texas is a very significant state. There are almost 100 delegates that are involved there. It's a very key state in that part of the United States, as well as one of our largest states overall. And this is a state where my opponent, by tradition or otherwise, has made a big effort. And so we're doing our very best to come from an underdog position with a good leadership and Senator Tower and good volunteers by the hundreds, and I think good policies overseas as well as at home. So we're trying to do our very best to make sure that the people of Texas understand that we represent certain viewpoints both domestically as well as internationally.
It's been said, Mr. President, that a Reagan win in Texas would not be nearly as significant as a Ford loss. What does that mean?
Well, that, I think, is an oversimplification, really. We feel that a Ford win in Texas would be very significant. We feel that an even balance of the delegates in Texas would be I think, very helpful because the leaders in the opposition feel they're going to do much better than that. Ford loss in Texas, I think, would not be good from our point of view because it might have an impact on several of the surrounding states like Oklahoma, possibly Georgia, possibly Alabama. So that's why we're making as big an effort as we possibly can. My wife is in Texas. My son has been there, Jack, and he's going again. I've been there once, and I'm going back for 4 days. We want to lay our programs out, answer any questions, and show our great concern and interest in Texas, and hopefully do better than what the speculators are saying.
Mr. President, there's a politically potent force in Texas by the name of John Connally. Has Mr. Connally decided whether he will endorse you for the Texas primary?
I had a very good meeting with John Connally here in the White House about a week or 10 days ago. John Connally didn't offer to support me. I didn't ask him for his support. I think John Connally's position is a very understandable one, and therefore it's better that he stand off and not endorse either me or my opponent. I think it's best for the Republican Party in Texas, considering the big contest in November, if John Connally takes the position that he's taken.
A story came out recently that reported that Mr. Connally would be the new Secretary of State if you are elected. There were denials from both here at the White House and from Mr. Connally. How do stories like that get started?
I wish I knew, because as John Connally said, and as we said here at the White House, there had been no offer made nor any interest actually shown on the part of either party. So how that story got started, I have no idea.
At the same time, though, Mr. President, you're not ruling out Connally as a vice presidential candidate or a running mate.
I've said a number of occasions, and I repeat here, John Connally is one of the most competent public servants that I've ever met. I've known him a long time when he was Secretary of the Navy, and I was on the Defense Appropriations Committee, where I had many experiences, not only with him, but other top military and civilian leaders. I knew him as Secretary of the Treasury. I knew him as Governor. His talents are very, very significant. So I wouldn't rule John Connally out for any public office in the United States.
Mr. President, you said that you'd rather run against Hubert Humphrey than Jimmy Carter. Could you respond and clarify that a bit?
I don't recall putting it quite that way. I've been asked many times who I thought would get the Democratic nomination. I think Hubert Humphrey will get the nomination. I have said that it would be a good contest because Hubert Humphrey's record is on the book, so to speak, in the United States Senate as Vice President and by his numerous speeches. So there would be a clear-cut difference between Hubert Humphrey's philosophy domestically and my philosophy. It would give the American people a good choice. So therefore, I think a contest between Hubert and myself would be good for our political system. Since Mr. Carter is less decisive in where he stands on many issues, a campaign between him and myself wouldn't be as clear-cut a discussion or a debate or a contest.
Back to the vice presidential question for just a moment before we move on. Is there any possibility of a woman being put on your ticket?
I don't rule out any fully qualified individual, and we do have some very outstanding women, not only in my administration, but in other public office. The Secretary of HUD, Carla Hills, who had been an Assistant Attorney General and is now Secretary of HUD in the Cabinet, is an example of a fully qualified individual. But whether the convention will select a woman or not, I think it's premature to make any real speculation.
Mr. President, it seems as though a good deal of this campaign so far has been devoted to one issue, and that is Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, even though many do not believe that Mr. Kissinger is an issue. Has his position hurt you at all in this campaign?
I don't think so. What you're really saying, or what ought to be said, is not the Secretary of State as such. It's our foreign policy. It's the foreign policy of the Ford administration. I think it's been successful. We have peace. We have the strength and the diplomatic skill to keep ourselves at peace and to meet any adversary, either diplomatically or military. We have the capability to strengthen our relationships with our allies, either in Europe or elsewhere. And Secretary Kissinger has carried out the Ford administration foreign policy very successfully. And so I don't think we should discuss personalities. I believe the discussion ought to be on whether or not the policy has been successful. And when I look at our successes, our achievements, I think the United States internationally today is in good shape. We are at peace. We have the strength to maintain that both diplomatically and militarily.
Mr. President, so many people now may not realize it, but you're the one who coined the phrase credibility gap. Do you think that that one exists now?
I see no reason why anyone should make that allegation. Certainly this administration has been more open, more candid, more forthright than any other administration, certainly during my 27 years in Washington, D.C. We do promise only what we can perform, and we perform everything that we promise. I think we have a very open administration. And if you have an open administration, I see no reason for a credibility gap.
One of your key jobs when you became president was to restore faith in our government. Do you feel
sure
that you've done
that? As I, and I apologize for interrupting, but we have tried to restore faith in the presidency by this frankness and candor. We certainly came into the office with a total clearance by the House and the Senate, by not only the many investigations that were undertaken, but the votes among the Democratic Congress. I was looking at some facts and figures the other day, and while I was being investigated on the nomination for the vice presidency, about 400 FBI agents went through my life history. And that's a lot of FBI agents to be looking at what you've done during your lifetime. But the point is, we have restored, I think, faith in the individual who occupies the White House. Now, people can disagree with my policies, but I think they believe that what I'm trying to do is done openly and frankly.
Mr. President, it's been almost 2 years since the Arab oil embargo against the United States. Could you give us a progress report on our country's efforts to achieve energy self-sufficiency?
In the field of conservation of energy, we're doing quite well. I just got a report for 1975, and we have reduced our energy consumption from the high point of 1973. So we're making headway in conservation. We are not making the kind of headway that I think we ought to make in developing new domestic sources. As a matter of fact, our domestic production of oil is gradually going down. We've got to give some incentive to the individuals who are seeking to find new sources. And although the bill that I signed was not the bill that I recommended, it will give us new incentives over a 40-month period so that people will explore for more domestic oil sources in the months ahead. And with the Alaskan pipeline coming through and by the spring of next year, and with our bigger effort to develop coal resources, our efforts in geothermal and solar energy, over the period from now till 1985, I believe that the United States will achieve a high degree of energy independence. It's not growing as rapidly as I would like it right now, but we are making significant progress.
Mr. President, the Arab oil embargo created a good deal of hardship for our country as far as petroleum-based products are concerned. What is the possibility that this country, if such an event should reoccur, would be in a position to, shall we choose the word, bargain with our agriculture power?
Well, the countries that produce most of the oil around the world, the major oil producers in the Middle East, as well as in Africa, as well as some in Latin America, are not the countries that are in greatest need of our agricultural production. Our farmers do a superior job. They are the most productive in the history of the world in agricultural production. But unfortunately, the countries that produce oil around the world aren't necessarily the countries that need our agricultural production. Now, there are some countries where we can, I hope, develop a relationship so we wouldn't be faced with a total oil embargo. There were some countries that didn't totally embargo us in 1973. In the meantime, on the basis of the recommendation that I made to the Congress and the Congress acting, we are starting to develop our program for the storage of a sufficient or a significant amount of oil in case of any emergency such as we had in 1973.
Mr. President, we're going to pause right here and change cassettes.
Are you all going back tonight or today?
Yes.
We'll go back tonight, yes, sir.
Will this go on, what, at 6 o'clock or 11 o'clock?
We're trying to do this now just exactly as if it were a live presentation. And it will, it's been scheduled for the air this next Tuesday from 7:30 until 8 in the evening.
Using any little bits and pieces
of it before the whole thing? Nope. Let me know what you do. When do you? As I understand it, this will be on several other stations,
yes,
including Fort Wayne, Indianapolis,
mm-hmm. Tulsa, Sacramento.
Sacramento. Mm-hmm. Where is the headquarters of this network?
New York City.
New York.
Corporate,
yes.
Headquarters are there. Our station is the flag. What's wrong? Sure, whatever you say.
Cameras?
Yes, sir.
It really works better than a single camera.
Oh, definitely. What this will allow us to do is roll all three tapes at the mm-hmm. same time when we get back to a 2-inch tape, and then the director, or when the producer, when he makes a master copy, will be able to go from one camera to the other as though we're doing a live show.
I see. And you bring all your own personnel as well as equipment up?
We brought all of our own equipment. We got a third camera from CBS and got a crew from them also. Everybody else is ours. Mm-hmm. We're ready?
12 minutes.
Are you ready? Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mr. President, continuing with that current train of thought concerning oil-producing nations and what have you, problems that were caused here by the energy crisis, the energy crunch, what about the use of nuclear power in our country? Would that help? Is it needed? Is it necessary at all?
Nuclear power, even today, is a very significant contributor to our total energy capability. We have roughly 55 operating nuclear plants today. By 1985, we hope to have roughly 250. It's very, very important that we continue the development of nuclear energy. We have to make it even safer than it is, and it's had a good safety record. We have to improve the reliability of it. Its reliability is good, but it can be done better. And we have to make certain that the protection or the safeguarding of the elements will be improved as well. But we're making excellent progress in this regard, and nuclear power is bound to be a significant factor by 1985.
What about the safety factor, sir?
Well, the safety record of nuclear power in this country today is perhaps one of the best of any of our energy producing capabilities. I saw a figure the other day that the chance of any accident of any significance is 1 in 5 billion. It's less than the probability of an individual in the United States being hit by a meteor. So I think the odds are pretty good and the safety record's excellent.
Mr. Ford, you were quoted as saying once that if Congress votes to cut the defense budget, it votes for war. Now, the Congress has been less than liberal as far as defense spending is concerned. How do we stand in relation to the Soviet Union with our defenses?
Right now, I believe that our military capability is unsurpassed by any nation in the world, including the Soviet Union. We have adequate military forces, and I mean fully adequate military forces, to maintain our national security, to deter aggression, and to maintain the peace. Now, if the trend of the last 6 years, imposed by substantial congressional cuts, totaling about $33 billion, was to continue, if that trend imposed by the Congress was to continue with their budget slashes, then in the years ahead, 3 to 5 years, our situation would be different. But that is why last year, in January of 1975, I submitted the highest military budget in the history of the United States. And unfortunately, the Congress in 1975 and 76 cut that budget by $6 billion+. In January of this year, in order to maintain our unsurpassed capability, I submitted again the highest military budget in the history of the United States. Fortunately, we've been able to now convince the Congress that that habit they had for 6 or 8 years of slashing the defense budget has to be broken. And we have good preliminary success in the Congress, both the House and the Senate, that they're going to give to me the kind of a military budget with the programs and policies that I recommended, so our capability will be maintained not only in 1976, but in the years ahead.
Speaking of billions of dollars, if I may, sir, what about the B-1 bomber?
Do we know? In the budget that I submitted last year and the budget I submitted this year, I recommended additional funds for B-1 research and development and B-1 production. I firmly believe that the B-1 is a necessary follow-on to our B-52s, just like I think that the Trident submarine is a necessary follow-on to our Polaris and Poseidon submarines. In my two budgets that I submitted for the Defense Department, we are continuously upgrading our military capability, both strategically and conventionally. And if the Congress goes along with this military budget that I submitted in January of this year, we will continue our total capability to maintain the peace, defend our national security, and deter aggression.
Mr. President, as a congressman, you are well known as an expert on national security and aerospace weapons development, despite the rigors of the presidency. Are you still able to keep up on top of that?
Well, I was very fortunate. For 14 years in the Congress, I was on the Defense Appropriations Committee with Congressman George Mahon, who is well known in Texas, certainly, as well as elsewhere. I had the benefit of every year listening to the recommendations of the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all of the experts, civilian as well as military, in the development of our program. So it's my feeling that I came to the presidency with the best background on military problems of any president, certainly in the last 30 or 40 years. So it's been very helpful to have had that experience as we wrestle with the problems we're facing today.
What about more military aid in the Middle East, Mr. President? Israel continues to want Pershing missiles. Your administration has said no.
Well, let me give you a little background on that, because it's a very legitimate discussion. I have recommended for the current fiscal year $2.3 billion for Israel, $1.5 billion of that for military aid, and $800 million for economic aid. For the next fiscal year, I recommended $1 billion in military aid and $700 million in economic aid. So what I've recommended is the greatest amount of money for Israel of any president in the United States. I think that's right, because it's important that Israel have the necessary capability to, economically as well as military, to survive and to maintain their own security. Now, unfortunately, some members of Congress have added something over what I've recommended. All of my technical experts in the Defense Department and other departments tell me that that extra $500 million over the $4.5 billion that I recommended is not necessary. So I have to be firm in saying no for the extra money, because we're asking all kinds of domestic departments to reduce, to tighten their belt. Now, I can't ask for understanding here at home if the Congress is going to add extra money, which I don't think, on basis of experts, tell me isn't needed.
Mr. President, let's talk about you for a moment. How are you enjoying the presidency?
I really enjoy it. I enjoy getting to work every morning about 7:30, 7:45, after I've spent several hours over in the residence reading documents, newspapers, news reports. I am never anxious to quit during the day. I enjoy the challenges of the job, whether it's struggling with domestic problems, or whether it's discussing foreign policy, or whether it's working with the Congress. It's a real thrill and a challenge to me, and I seem to thrive on it.
Your son Jack was down in Houston recently, and he mentioned that sometimes the rigors of being in the first family are a little too much. Is it like that for all the members of your family? Have they adjusted to living here in the White House?
I think they've all adjusted very well. It was quite a transition. An 18-year-old girl having Secret Service agents around when she goes on a date, or a 19-year-old boy who takes a girl out, you know, it's not a normal circumstance. And Jack, who is now 24, he had been accustomed to freedom as he went through college, but I think they've all adjusted. They have an excellent relationship with the Secret Service detail that is assigned to them, and it just took a little time for them to get over the life they had lived and the life that they were going to have to live as long as I was president.
Jack has made did quite a good job for you at the University of Houston, and Mrs. Ford, of course, is coming to Texas with the CB radio and what have you. Speaking of your campaign, has really become a marvelous family effort.
Well, Jack, as well as Betty, have really pitched in, and every report I get is that they do better than I do, and If I look at the polls, Mrs. Ford's popularity is better than mine.
Does Mrs. Ford really enjoy going out on campaign for Ford?
Yes, she does. She was looking forward to this trip down to Texas. She's going to San Antonio and to Houston and several other communities. She likes people like I like people. She believes in what I'm doing, and she wants to help to make sure that those views or those policies are continued. So she's a real teammate in this kind of an effort, and so I appreciate it. It permits me to stay here and do the work in the Oval Office and handle the jobs of the presidency, and they're out campaigning. It just permits me to do this job first and at the same time get some campaigning in.
Mr. Ford, in the brief remaining time that we have, Jerry Ford of old used to wear a green eye shade when he went over the budget. Does he still do that?
I certainly do. I spent 100 hours in November and December going over the budget with the OMB and with cabinet officers, and we made every department justify every dollar that they get. And as a result, I think we submitted a good budget that can be totally defended.
Mr. Ford, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see you both and to be on the program.